come on! Get away!
Quick!
Into the time machine!
That was a close call.
With luck, my love, we will never experience such danger again.
Oh, are you sure?
Yes. I am taking us into the future.
Oh.
A future so distant that vampires will have become extinct. So distant that the world will have forgotten that we ever existed.
What? No more villagers chasing us with crosses and sticks?
Yes.
Oh, no more hiding from the sun and sleeping in coffins?
Yes.
Oh.
And moreover, plentiful food.
Oh.
An unsuspecting, totally vulnerable planet full of blood-rich victims.
Oh.
We can dine at our leisure. No more furtive hunting. No more lurking in shadows. All the blood we can drink.
Oh, blood. Delicious blood. Oh, Vlad, darling, how do you know there is such a future?
It is a chance we have to take.
Uh-huh.
I have set the controls for a very remote era.
We haven't partaken in weeks. I am thirsty, my husband.
As am I.
How long will it take for us to get to this utopian future?
We are there now.
Oh, good. I am famished.
Here goes nothing.
Oh.
Greetings, strangers. Welcome.
This looks promising. Greetings. My name is Vladimir, and this is my wife, Sophia.
Hello.
I am called Brassicus. What brings you to our shores? Are you tourists?
No, we have come in a time machine from remote antiquity to seek a new home.
Yes, we are fleeing the tyranny of vampires.
Vampires? What are vampires?
Vlad, he's never heard of vampires.
I know. Vampires are cruel and ruthless creatures.
Well, you will find no vampires here. They must be some sort of human hybrid.
You're right, in a manner of speaking.
Well, then you are completely safe. There are no humans anymore.
Well, there aren't. Then, sir, what are you?
The human race is extinct. My people are all descended from what was once known as vegetation.
Vegetation?
Yes. Plants and flowers and trees, that sort of thing. Why, my remote ancestor was what humans called a turnip.
National Public Radio presents a production of the Hollywood Theater of the Year, 2000X. Radio series devoted to stories of the next millennia. Now, here is your host, the award-winning writer and critic, Harlan Ellison.
We decided that we're going to give you a really overflowing, groaning board of goodies this time. Not one, not two, not three. What comes out? Four. Four. There'll be four wonderful little playlets. You've just heard the first one, Phil Proctor, Linda Peterson, and Ira Burton in Blood by Frederick Brown. Frederick Brown, the master of the short, short story. The short, sharp punch under the heart that knocks you for a loop. I love Blood. That's a wonderful story. Particularly for someone who hates lima beans. Well, I hate lima beans. You show me someone who'll eat a lima bean without a gun to their head, I'll show you a pervert. And the second one is a story by my all-time favorite writer. The man's name is Gerald Kirsch, K as in Kirsch, K-E-R-S-H. He was born in 1911, he died in 1968, he died prematurely. He was a great, great storyteller, ladies and gentlemen. He had 19 novels and 21 short story collections published. but 21 of those books were never published in the United States. He wrote novels, short stories, articles about mystery, science fiction, war, any subject you could think about. In fact, you know the famous movie, The Dead of Night? Well, there was a legend that the section with the dummy in it, the evil dummy, was based on a cursed story. And recently, in correspondence that has just been discovered, the screenwriter of that piece sent his script to Kirsch, saying that Kirsch's story was his inspiration, but that he changed the story while retaining the spirit, and would Kirsch object? So Kirsch then asked his friend and newspaper editor Harry Ainsworth to compare the script with the original story. And Ainsworth said he thought they read as if they were both written by the same author. Kirsch then proceeded to grant the film writer permission to go ahead and use the script, saying that he wouldn't mind and that he didn't require even screen credit. Tonight's number is Kirsch's A Little Bank Deposit.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Am I intruding?
Well, as a matter of fact, this Stein of Ale was telling a very amusing story about a commercial traveler and a farmer's daughter. I suppose it could wait.
It's just that you look awfully familiar.
Well, have we met previously?
Well, not really. My name is Harlow Ellis. I'm a science writer for CNN. I was standing by the bar when I saw you sitting alone here, and I thought, that gentleman looks like the photographs in our files of the distinguished physicist Sir Peter Perfermant.
Oh, those photographs must be, what, 30 years old?
30 years at the inside.
Well, you must have a sharp eye indeed if you recognize me by those old photographs. I fancy I must have changed somewhat since then. But, yes, I am Peter Perfermant, and they did make a night of me for some trifling work I did on nuclear physics.
What a stroke of luck. Vacationing in London and running into Sir Peter Perfermant. I've been an admirer of yours for quite some time, Sir Peter.
Oh, an admirer, eh? Oh, well, do sit down.
Why, thank you.
I am glad for once to be recognized. You might otherwise mistake me for an escaped convict or a lunatic at large or something of that sort. For I'm going to beg you to have the goodness to sit in this shadowy corner and keep your broad back between me and the door.
Gladly, Sir Peter. But why?
Well, have an eye on the mirror over my head, and you will in due course see the reflections of a couple of elbows who will come into this cozy little pub. Those men will be looking for me.
You don't want them to find you?
You will perceive by the complete vacuity of their expressions that they are from intelligence.
MI5? What do they want with you?
To carry me off. Evading those two young men is one of the few pleasures left me in my old age. Once I got out in a laundry basket. Tonight I put on workman's overalls over my dinner suit and went to a concert. I intend to go back to the center after I've had my evening, but I want to be left alone a bit. Of course, I have nobody but myself to blame for any slight discomfort I may at present suffer.
How so? I thought you had retired.
Oh, I did retire. In 1990, when the Cold War was running down. My work, it seemed, was over. So I withdrew to a pleasant little villa at the Cap des Fesses, just outside that awful holiday resort, Les Sables des Fesses, in the south of France. Fully intended to end my days there, as a matter of fact. Set up a library and study there, and a compact but middling comprehensive laboratory. I went to all the music festivals, drank my glass of wine on the terrace of whatever cafe happened to take my fancy, and continued my academic battle with Dr. Frankenberg. Fluorine, ladies and gentlemen, is the enfant terrible of the elements. In temperament, it is a prima donna, and in character, a born delinquent.
A moment, Sir Peter. I am confused. Have we gathered here to discuss particle physics, opera, or pediatrics?
I was employing metaphors, Dr. Frankenberg. There's no reason for scientific discourse to be dry as dust, is there?
Ah, dust! May be dry, Sir Peter, but one can examine it under the microscope. One cannot do that with a metaphor.
May I continue, Dr. Frankenberg?
If you must.
Fluorine cannot be kept in a pure state. It has an affinity for practically everything else on Earth, and what it has an affinity for, it tends to destroy. My theory involves what I can only describe as tame fluorine. Fluorine as housebroken and in harness.
Absurd. Fluorine will always pee-pee on the floor and resist the bridle.
Oh, well, now who's using metaphors?
At least mine aren't mixed.
I say it is possible to produce a stable fluorine.
And I say you might as well imagine Bart Simpson as Pope.
If Frankenberg is such an ass as you say, why do you bother?
It's the principle of the thing, my dear Rosine. I am right, and Frankenberg is wrong. You see, in its natural state, fluorine...
Explain me no explanations. I am an architect, not a scientist. I'm not even an architect anymore. Just another emigre from the former Eastern Bloc. I would not understand your elucidation, my friend, nor do I care to. What does it matter? Well, if you will pardon me, I am going to stroll down to the topless beach.
Now, at your age, do you still indulge in that sort of thing?
I maintain an academic interest in naked women. It passes the time. Care to join me?
No. I must get back to my laboratory.
Suit yourself.
Rosine, open up!
Preferman, what are you doing pounding on my door like the KGB?
I've come with marmalade, relish, and this.
What is it?
Something special for tea, my dear Rosine.
Smoked salmon?
No.
Obviously, you have just paid a visit to the Café de la Guerre Froide.
Nope. I've just come from the bank.
So, that's a parcel of money, I suppose. What's it to me? Let's have tea.
I didn't go to the bank to take something out, Rosine. I put something in.
Make me no mystification, if you please. What's that?
That is proof positive that Frankenberg is wrong and I am right, Rosine. What you see there is half a dozen ounces of absolutely stable fluorine 80 plus. And a critical mass at that.
Jargon, me no jargon. As I understand it, an atomic explosion takes place when certain quantities of radioactive material arrive in certain circumstances at what you call critical mass. But this being the case, that little packet, may I take it, be considered dangerous?
Oh, rather so. There's about enough fluorine 80 plus there to vaporize a medium-sized planet.
Fluorine bomb, an ounce of nitroglycerin, it's all the same to me. Tell me, Preferment, how do you make it go off? Not, I gather, chucking it about on tables.
No, it's completely inert. You could beat it with a sledgehammer or burn it with a blow lamp and nothing would happen. You can't explode it, well, as you understand an explosion, except under conditions difficult to create and useless once created. Although perhaps, while valueless as a weapon, it could be put to peaceful uses.
Perhaps, me no perhapses. A fighting cock could be used to make chicken broth. What did you want to bring it here for anyway?
Well, neither you nor anyone else will ever see fluoride 80 plus again. In about 14 hours, that piece there will, as you would put it, evaporate.
Why, as I would put it? How do you put it?
Why, you see, in point of actual fact, that stuff is exploding now. Only it's exploding very, very gradually. Now, for this explosion to be effectual as an explosion, we should have to let that mass expand at a temperature of anything over 60 degrees Fahrenheit in a hermetically sealed bomb case of at least 10,000 cubic feet in capacity. At this point, given suitable pressure, up she'd go. But when I tell you that before we could get such a pressure under which my fluorine 80 plus would undergo certain atomic alterations, the casing of our 10,000 cubic foot bomb would need to be at least 2 or 3 feet thick.
It's a chimera. Solid, it evaporates. Burn your formula. Pay no further attention to it. Still, since you brought it, let's have a look at it. A notebook. Nothing here but a notebook. I knew all along it was a joke.
Good heavens. That ought to be safe in the bank. That's the formula.
And the bomb?
No, not a bomb, Rezin. I've told you that fluorine 80 plus can't possibly be a bomb of its own accord. Confound it, I must have left it at the grocer shop.
Is it poisonous?
Toxic? I don't think so. Now, wait a minute. I distinctly remember when I left the house, I put the formula in my right-hand coat pocket and the fluorine 80 plus in the left. Now, first of all, I went to the Épicerie Internationale to get this marmalade and stuff. And so as not to crowd my left pocket, I transferred... this is quite all right, Rezin. Oh, there's nothing to worry about, except that this is not the kind of notebook I like to carry about with me. Oh, no, the sample is safe and sound in the bank. It was a natural mistake. The packages are very much alike in shape and weight. No cause for anxiety. Pass the gentleman's relish, will you?
This horrible little bit of fluorine, you left it in the bank, did you? You bank at the Maritime.
Yes, why?
So do I. It's the safest bank in France. Its walls... Now follow me carefully, Perforant. Its walls are burglar-proof, bomb-proof, fire-proof, and absolutely airtight. The safety deposit vault is 40 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 10 feet high. This gives it a capacity of 12,000 cubic feet. It is maintained at a low humidity and constant temperature of 65 degrees Fahrenheit. The walls of this vault are of hard steel and reinforced concrete 3 feet thick. The door alone weighs 30 tons, but fits like a glass stopper in a medicine bottle. Does the significance of all this sink in?
Why?
Yes, why? No. You can say that again, why? What you have done, my irresponsible friend, is put your mess of fluorine 80 plus in its impossible casing.
Good heavens.
That's the way with the likes of you. It would never have dawned on you that a bomb might be an oblong thing as big as a bank. Congratulations!
I know the manager, Monsieur Lecoeur, and he knows me. I'll go and see him at once.
It's Saturday. The bank's closed by now.
Yes, I know, but I'll ask him to come over with his keys.
Here is a phone. Ring him up.
Monsieur Lecoeur, s'il vous plaît. Où est-il? Sir Peter Perforant. C'est un cas pressant. Oui. Oui. Oh, merci. He's gone for the weekend. To his bungalow in La Fère. No answer.
Undoubtedly he is out somewhere enjoying his holiday.
I must search for him.
La Fère is 80 miles away.
I shall find a taxi.
Good luck. It's carnival weekend. You will not find a taxi.
For you, Sir Peter, anything but to open the bank. No, I cannot oblige.
Well, you'd better, Monsieur Lecoeur.
But, Sir Peter, this is not merely a matter of turning a key and opening the door.
It isn't?
I don't believe you can have read our brochure. The door at the vault is on a time lock. This means that after the lock is set and the door closed, nothing can open it until a certain period of time has elapsed.
Yes.
So, precisely at 7:45 on Monday morning, but not one instant before, I can open the vault for you.
But then, as I see it, you'd better send for the locksmith and have the lock picked.
Ha! You couldn't open our vault without taking the door down. Uh-huh. We are, after all, the safest bank in France.
Well, then I'm afraid I'll have to trouble you to have the door taken down.
That would necessitate practically taking down the bank.
Then there is nothing for it but to take down the bank. Of course, there'll be compensation, I suppose. Still, the fact remains that by the sheerest inadvertence, for which I hold myself greatly at fault, I have turned your bank vault into a colossal bomb.
Ah, oh, mon Dieu.
A bomb compared with which your American multi-megaton hydrogen bombs are milk and water. Indeed, you'd no more weigh or measure my fluorine 80 plus in terms of mere megatons than you'd buy coal by the milligram or wine by the cubic centimeter.
Monsieur, one of us is going crazy.
Call a Hiroshima bomb a megaton. Dealing with my fluorine 80 plus, we have to make tables. So a million megatons equals one tyranniton. A million tyranitons equals one chasmaton. A million chasmatons make one brahmaton. And after a million brahmatons, we come to something I call an ultimon, because it is beyond even the scope of a mathematical conjecture.
Ah, les Anglais.
In a certain number of hours from now, and we are wasting precious time talking, Monsieur Lecoeur, if you don't get that vault of yours open, the universe will experience a shock of half a chasmaton. So please, please, Monsieur Lecoeur, let me use your telephone. Yes, Prime Minister. Of course, Prime Minister. I think it most advisable to get a move on, Prime Minister. Oh, thank you, Prime Minister. You have a nice day, too. Well, Monsieur Lecoeur, I managed to pull a few strings.
That was the Prime Minister of England?
I've not been a raging cold warrior for nothing. It's all arranged. Army and police are on the way. So are some colleagues of mine. The Custodia Safe Company, who installed your vault, are flying their best technicians into Fes. We'll have your vault open in a couple of hours or so. I'm sorry if this inconveniences you, but it's got to be done, and you must put up with it.
Inconveniences me? After this, Sir Peter Perfumant, you will kindly take your banking business elsewhere!
So, what is going on here?
Some trouble at the bank.
What sort of trouble?
I do not know. But I heard something about fluorine.
Which is...
I'm not sure. But they put it in toothpaste.
Hey, les bons! Foutez-moi le camp d'ici! Allez, allez!
My dear Dr. Frankenberg, how good to see you. And to report in the matter of fluorine, you have been totally confuted.
This better be good, Sir Peter. Security snatched me out of my home without so much as a guten tag, and I found myself on a plane with three other Nobel laureates, all of whom are singularly out of countenance, as am I.
Here, Frankenberg, take this.
What is it?
All my notes. It will inform you and your fellow Nobelists why the fluorine 80 plus locked up in that bank requires immediate and heroic measures. Now, your friends are all over there by the pastry kiosk. Help yourself to a profiterole and a café au lait and share those notes with them while I try to settle an argument.
All right. I hope there are no metaphors in this.
Now, gentlemen.
Sir Peter, back me up in this. I have been telling the mayor and the chief of police here that one must always evacuate the area surrounding an unexploded bomb until it is defused. He refuses to order the evacuation of Sable Death's feces.
Je m'en fiche de la bombe. It is Mardi Gras, Carnival. You cannot empty Sable Death's without ruining it. I will not do it. Non, better death than dishonor.
You may ease your mind on that score, Monsieur le Maire. If my fluorine 80 plus blows, Monsieur, the problem of evacuation will not arise, for nobody anywhere ever will be any the wiser.
I've done hundreds of terrorist bomb scares, and we always remove the civilians. It's protocol.
As chief of police, it is my opinion that the present danger is only hypothetical. But the panic that must attend the mass alarm would be inevitably disastrous.
What do you recommend, Auguste?
It is only necessary to surround the block.
Who are you going to believe? A provincial police chief or an outside expert?
I assure you, monsieur, the danger is far from hypothetical.
So you claim, monsieur, so you claim. But I have my doubts. I would not be surprised if this is all an elaborate ruse. How you say, a put-in job to get the bank vault open.
But the Almel car has been and gone, and the bank is just about empty of cash until Monday.
Monsieur Lecure, have you never heard of Raffles?
Raffles? Huh? The Marchioness de la Croupe sponsors an annual raffle to benefit the orphanage, but I do not.
Raffles is not a thing. He is a person, a gentleman burglar, one who has no need to steal, but who indulges in crime for the mere pleasure of it.
But it is not this Monsieur Raffles who has placed the bomb in the vault. It is Sir Peter.
Precisely.
Good Lord, sir, Raffles is a fictional character.
He is British. You are British, QED.
Voilà!
Sir Peter is a well-renowned man of science. Surely you don't mean to suggest...
Poppycock! What's your language?
It is a free country. I am entitled to my suspicions.
Oh, nothing is being accomplished here. Excuse me, gentlemen. Am I going to see what my fellow scientists think about this?
They are having coffee on land.
Ah, here is preferment now.
Well, gentlemen, what do you make of the situation?
I want to check and double-check. I want a computer. I want 5 days.
Come, we must grant the possibility that what we read here is valid. Even for the sake of argument, we must grant it.
Well, for the sake of argument.
You know, I find this case very interesting. You know, any relaxation of pressure must render preferment so-called fluorine 80 plus harmless, must it not? This being the case, a hole drilled in the vault door should prove an ample measure of precaution. This hole made, why, let the matter wait until Monday.
So be it, as he talks sense.
Yes. Yes, bore holes. Leave performance thing until Monday. But, unless I misread this formula, his so-called fluorine 80 plus will, by that time, have ceased to exist.
Metaphysics, Dr. Frankenberg.
What about metaphysics?
If we live it, it ceases to exist. If we don't live it, it ceases to exist. But, as I read Perfumer's notes, if we live fluorine 80 plus, we shall be involved with it in a state of non-existence. Better bore holes.
Brazine, what are you doing here? I thought you were indifferent to this whole business.
I am. After all, doom is a necessary consequence of living. But I had nothing better to do. Here, I brought you some tea in this thermos. How are things going?
Under control, my friend. The engineers from the Custodia Company have arrived by helicopter. They're inside setting up equipment so they can bore a hole in the vault.
I recognize Monsieur Lequet, but who are the rest of these people?
Well, that's Frankenberg.
Ah, the notorious Frankenberg.
And my colleagues Schiappa, Imhoff and Wang, a demolition specialist from security, the mayor, the chief of police.
A committee of experts, as it were.
Yeah, more or less.
Our fate is sealed.
And herein, they are bringing in gas masks.
Monsieur, what are the gas masks for?
The what?
Les masques à gaz, what are they for?
Bon, when the door is in any way interfered with, the alarm automatically goes off. We omit no precautions, none whatsoever. As soon as the alarm goes off, the vaults fill with tear gas from built-in containers.
Did you say tear gas?
In a high concentration.
Then get away from the door at once.
Why? What is wrong?
Frankenberg, you hate every word I say, old fellow, but you're an honest man. Conceding that my notes are right, and I swear they are, you'll see that my fluorine 80 plus has one affinity, one only. That is with C8H7C10, chloroacetophenone. And that, damn, is the stuff tear gas is made of!
If your notes are accurate, and I am still checking the math, it is true.
Oh, merde!
slice it as you like. We've had it.
This, I believe, is what the dramatists call a perfectly damnable impasse. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Is there no part of this place that is not guarded by alarm?
Technically, there is only one part of our vault that's reachable from the outside, if you can call it the outside.
This is no time to quibble over nomenclature, monsieur.
The back of our vault abuts on the back of the jeweler's next door.
Mannequins?
Oui. His vault, you see, is itself 2 feet thick. Hence,
get this monkey in there here at once.
In a moment, the Hollywood Theater of the Ear will return with the conclusion of A Little Bank Deposit. You're listening to 2000X from NPR, National Public Radio.
Local underwriting is provided by European Sleepworks, the Berkeley store that offers individually adjusting mattresses in the European style and bedroom furniture in a variety of styles and hardwoods. More details are on the web at sleepworks.com.
Let's say you're a woman and a former Enron employee. You've lost your job, your savings, and the money you got from selling your copy of the ethics manual, and eBay is just about gone. Along comes an offer that might keep the bills paid, but it calls for a kind of exposure that even Arthur Anderson can't cover up. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we calmly discuss this ethical dilemma, as well as the turn-ons and turn-offs in the week's news, on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We'll be on at 10 o'clock, and at 11 we'll have This American Life, about children and parents not getting along, not being able to talk without degenerating into a fight. Sound familiar? Probably to most of us. This is KQED Public Radio.
Have you missed programs in the 2000X series? Would you like to have your own copies? Well, you can now find 2000X and other fine NPR programs on the World Wide Web. I'll give you the Internet address at the end of today's program so that you may have pencil and paper handy. For now, here once again is your host, Harlan Ellison.
And now, Act Two of A Little Bank Deposit by Gerald Kirsch.
I'd open my vault with pleasure, but I have a partner, Vormadam. Our vault opens by two combination locks, which must be operated simultaneously. These locks are so placed that no one can operate both at the same time. I have my own secret combination, and Vormadam has his. We must both be present to open the vault.
This is how one gets rich.
That is how one stays rich.
Where is this Vormadam?
In London.
Milford, what is all that racket out there?
An aircraft has landed on the driveway, Lady Farrington.
Well, tell them to go away. Silently.
Which one of you is Jacob Vormadam?
Who are you? What do you mean by barging into a private residence?
MI5, Lady Farrington. Official business.
Outrageous.
Which one of you gents is Vormadam?
I am Vormadam.
Come with us!
I have no doubts whatsoever. The case is open and shut, as far as I am concerned.
We have opened our vault for you, Monsieur Le Cris, so be so good as to...
This, Sir Peter Preferment, is no less than a cunning master criminal. A veritable Moriarty.
Time runs out.
His real objective is the jeweler's strongroom.
Begin the drilling!
Keep your eye on him, man, if he makes one false move.
Imagination, my friends. Nothing but imagination is making us all sweat. All things considered, do you think that a Megaton, a Pteranodon, or an Altman could do us personally more harm than, let us say, a pound of dynamite?
Aha! You know a lot about dynamite, it seems.
I should hope so. I was sabotaging Soviet missiles, my friend, when you were still swinging a truncheon on the Rue des Poutins.
Thank you.
It is getting light out there.
What time is it, someone?
11 and one half minutes after 5.
Well, gentlemen, we've broken through.
Fine. Well, you can take it easy now. Fluorine 80 plus can't blow.
C'est bien, sir.
Is this it, this here powder?
Yes, indeed.
One of our men shimmied through the hole and snatched it up.
Look, Frankenberg, see how greatly it's diminished? We've had a close call.
I am still checking them up.
Well, who's for a spot of tea?
How about a spot of tea, sir?
Kindly remove your hands from the neck of Sir Peter.
Thank you, Chief Inspector.
Sir Peter Persimmon, you are under arrest.
Arrest? What
think
for?
Think you could get away with it, monsieur.
Get away with what?
Just what are you going on?
Tonight,
about?
When every policeman in Sable de Fesse and its environs was here, Sir Peter's accomplices broke into the galleries of Monsieur le Prince de Mamluk.
No! What?
The Prince of Mamluk is one of the finest private art collections in the world.
Exactement. His precious collection of antique jewels, poof! His Rembrandts, his Holbeins, his Raphaels, his Titians, and so on. Poof. All poof. Poof, poof, poof. Oh. The accomplices. They too are poof. But the ringleader, the mastermind, he is not poof. He is none other than Sir Peter Perfumon, creator of the diversion that made the theft possible.
I had nothing to
lock
do with
him up! Send him to the guillotine! Come quietly, monsieur.
Resine, Frankenberg, help me!
Don't worry, Perfumon. They will not sodomize you. You are too old.
I will send you a laptop. You can check your own map.
Carruthers, ring up the Home Office on the cell phone.
Greatest art burglary of all time, I'm told. They say that Lloyd's would rather have lost a fleet of transatlantic liners than what they underwrote those pictures for.
Were the thieves ever caught?
No.
And you?
Well, taking it by and large, I suppose it was for my own good that I was shipped back to England and put under guard. If I'd had any sense, of course, I'd have kept quiet about that confounded fluorine 80 plus. As it is, I made a prisoner of myself.
But they must have realized you had nothing to do with the theft.
Oh, well, no one has ever taken that charge seriously, except the chief of police of Les Sables de Fesse.
Then why are you kept under lock and key?
Well, they regard me... Well, of all people, as a compulsive chatterbox. As if fluorine 80 plus is anything to chatter about. Why, you could make it yourself.
Really?
You take 500 grams of fluor... Here come my two friends. I'll take my leave of you now, sir. Good evening, gentlemen.
You have been listening to A Little Bank Deposit based on The Unsafe Deposit Box by Gerald Kirsch. In the cast you heard, Nathan Osgood as Ellis and the man from security, Tony Jay as Sir Peter, Stefan Rudnicki as Frankenberg, Phil Proctor as the banker, and Artie Johnson as the police chief, with Ira Burton and Lorna Raver. The play was dramatized, produced, and directed by Yuri Rosowski. Warren Dewey was recordist, and Craig Sandler was our mixer. Our third of four pieces is titled A Dialogue for the Year 2130. Extracted from the album of a modern Sybil by the author of Granby, who was actually T.H. Lister. And this was published in a London periodical at the end of 1829, shortly after the publication of Mary Shelley's extraordinarily pessimistic novel, The Last Man. This was written as an answer to it. We talk about all of the wonders of the future that we read about in Mechanics Illustrated and Popular Science when we were younger, and the world of tomorrow with the flying bridges and individual rocket packs for everyone, and we do it from a viewpoint not that far distant from our own time today. But in 1829,
What a strange, interesting, skewed view of the future they had that somehow or other winds up in the year 2130.
Ah, Lord M.
My dear Lady D.
Hello. Most unexpected persons both. I heard only yesterday that one of you was in Greenland and the other in Africa. What false reports they circulate.
Well, the reports were true not long ago, and I believe we returned about the same time. You, Lady D, have also been travelling, I believe.
Yes, we were out of England in the winter. Our physician recommended a warmer climate for Lord D, so we took a villa on the Niger, and afterwards spent a short time at Sakatul.
Oh, I suppose you found it full of English.
Oh, quite full. Oh, such a set. We hardly knew any of them. In fact, we did not go there for society. We met a few pleasant people, Australians, the Avershaws, the Hardy Vaux, and Sir William and Lady Soames.
Oh, did you go by the new Tangier and Timbuktu road?
Yes, we did, and we found it excellent. By the by, Lord A, to digress to a different latitude, how did you succeed in your last excursion to the North Pole?
To tell you the truth, extremely ill. We had most improvidently taken with us scarcely enough of the solvent to work our way through the ice, and our concentrated essence of caloric was found to be of a very inferior quality.
Oh, then I am afraid you did not get it at the right place.
But I am about to build a new iron yacht. And I shall try again next summer.
I believe we shall go to Spitsbergen ourselves.
A hint for you to offer to take them.
I know it, but it won't succeed. Oh, I'm happy to think that in that case I may perhaps have the pleasure of meeting you there on my return. You see, I must go to the pole by the way of North Georgia. I'm engaged to visit an Eskimo friend. Well parried, was it not?
Oh, what a bear. I wonder... You can like that Northwest Passage.
No.
Mrs. Winterblossom and I have vowed we will never go that way again. Mm. Poor Mrs. Winterblossom. I have been talking to her this afternoon through the telescope till my fingers ache.
Where is she?
About 2 miles out, at her house in Hamilton Place.
What? She's still there? I thought she meant to change her residence. I am surprised at her living so far out of the way.
Yes, it certainly is very strange. But I have been visiting this morning in a still more antiquated quarter of the world. Grosvenor Square, of all places.
Yes,
hope you won't inform against me.
I think you almost deserve that I should. But whom can you know in Grosvenor Square?
To tell you the truth, it was a visit rather of business than of pleasure. I wish to speak to one of the members of the managing committee of the new Calisthenic Academy for the Children of Pauper Operatives. They have appointed me one of the patronesses.
Oh.
Lady B is another. Have you seen Sir James lately?
Well, he quitted us only a few minutes before we had the pleasure of finding you here.
I wish you would scold him for me. I sent him an invitation for yesterday to dine, and he never came.
I think I heard him say that he was invited for tonight.
Yes.
Ah! Then I understand the reason. The fault is not his. The fact is that my automaton note-writer does make such dreadful mistakes that I really must have him taken to pieces. Do you know what he did the other day?
No.
He sent a note of condolence instead of congratulation.
Oh, dear.
And it was on the event of old Lord Battersea's marriage with that little flirt, Miss Pipkinson. Nothing could have been more unfortunate. I dare say I'm suspected of having done it on purpose. Mr. C, have you heard the new opera?
Do you mean Annabelle? Yes, I have heard it.
Is it not charming? How fine that passage of the Alps is. How well the music represents all that one can suppose to have been going on. The trampling and bellowing of the elephants, the thundering of the avalanches, the repeated blows of the hammers and mattocks. Then how magnificent is that chorus when they pour the vinegar down the rocks.
Yes, very fine, certainly. But somehow it sets my teeth on edge.
That is what it ought to do.
Quite.
Lord A, I believe you are fond of paintings. Have you been to the institution?
Not yet. I'm waiting for a cloudy day. The glare is so oppressive that my eyes will hardly bear it.
Then let me advise you to go in crepe spectacles.
Ah.
It is what I always do myself. Mm. Our modern painters certainly are magnificent colourists. But after all, I think I prefer the old masters.
So do I. And not only in painting, but in literature also. I must confess that our poets of the age of George the Tenth seem very inferior to those of George the Third and Fourth.
It is amusing to look at the descriptions of manners as they existed in those days.
Yes.
Human nature certainly appears to have been the same, but the modes of life seem strangely ridiculous and obsolete. What should we think now of dinner at 8 before the opera? or going to a party as early as midnight?
Oh,
conceive the barbarism of men sitting together after dinner when the ladies had retired, as they are made to do in those old novels.
Speaking of novels, what is this lying open on the settee? Love and Algebra?
Oh, don't look at it. It was brought by mistake. I am ashamed of the book. One of the common scientific novels that are thumbed by coal heavers and orange women. Mere trash of a low circulating library.
Well, I will plead guilty of having read it. And I really found it better than I expected. I rather liked a passage in it where the hero proposes to his mistress through the medium of a simple equation. He making himself the unknown quantity X. Oh, then there was a pretty good scene in which they investigate the binomial theorem and reduce a rival to the value of nothing.
Aye, that does very well for the common people. Everything is taught them now by means of scientific novels. Mm-hmm. Such as Geological Atoms or The Adventures of a Dustman and 100 other such books of that description. How learned the people are now. Were they learned formerly?
By no means. There was a time when not all of them could even read.
Oh, is it possible?
Oh, yes.
And were those bad times for the common people? Was there often a scarcity of food then, and were they reduced to live on pheasants and potatoes?
They were sometimes reduced to live upon little, but not upon pheasants and potatoes. Potatoes were then eaten chiefly by the Irish, and pheasants were not so common anywhere. They had, however, more corn then.
I heard Lord D say that corn is rising in price. What is the reason?
The harvest has failed in Tartary, and you know that the state of foreign harvests affects our prices much more than that of our own.
I wonder we don't grow corn in England enough to feed our own population.
Enough to feed our population? Oh, my dear Lady D, we have hardly enough to feed our game. Indeed, it is very much doubted whether English wheat is fit for anything but the brute creation.
But I suppose the people used it formerly.
Yes, but that was in dark times.
And what do you call dark times?
Oh, the 19th century.
Aye, it was about that period they held such long discussions on the subject of admitting Roman Catholics to sit in Parliament. It was then thought to be dangerous.
Dangerous. How many Catholics are there in the two houses at this moment?
To the best of my belief, not one. Pray, have you read the President's speech at the opening of the Parliament at Madrid? It is in a spirit more favourable to the Catholics than his last.
Where did you see the President's speech?
In a six-hourly paper. It was published about 2 hours ago.
Ah, you have the advantage. My paper is a half-daily one. I believe I must leave it off. One never knows any news till it's old.
Oh, very true. A half-daily paper leaves one several hours in arrear. Mm. But after all, nothing that appears in print can deserve the name of news. The only satisfactory intelligence is that which one receives by letter.
Certainly. And I agree with you. And apropos, as the hackney coachmen say. Apropos of letters, I received one this morning from a friend at Moscow. It was written the day before yesterday, and it contains a piece of information that is not generally known at present.
Oh, do tell.
My friend says they had received intelligence of an insurrection having broken out in Turkey.
Turkey? Where is that?
It is one of the southern provinces of Russia. The insurrection is supposed to have originated among the remnant of an ancient sect called Mohammedans, and to have been secretly fomented by those seditious levelers, the Austrians.
Bounders.
Those restless mortals are like the old French Jacobins. Not content with revolutionizing themselves, they wish to carry their pernicious doctrines into every other country.
Really? I wish they would imitate the steady monarchical governments of America. Talking of America reminds me of a letter I lately received from my friend, the Duke of Massachusetts. Mm. He gave a curious account of the visit which the King of Canada paid to His Majesty Jonathan III at Washington. Mm. War is expected between these two powers and the King of Carolina. They can never remain at peace long. Mm. There is perpetual jealousy amongst those North American kingdoms.
Yes. War is also expected in the East. It will be singular if war should break out at the same time in two opposite quarters of the globe, among a set of nations all of which speak English.
Oh, true, but you must remember that with the exception of a few countries in our little Europe, which retain their original languages, almost all the greatest nations do speak English. Yes. It's the language of three-fourths of Asia, 9/10 of North America, half Africa, and all the insular states in the South Seas.
And this little kingdom, with a population of not more than 40 millions, has had the honor of colonizing half the globe.
True. And at a time when our population was not much more than half what it is now.
It is a gratifying reflection.
Mm-hmm. Might one not say a mortifying one? These countries are our colonies no longer. How powerful we should have been if we had retained them.
Perhaps, Lady D, not much more powerful than we are at present. I might almost say perhaps not so powerful. If we look into history, we find that when the United States of America, as they were formerly called, and then Canada, India, Australia, successively fell from our grasp, at each time the most ruinous consequences were anticipated. And at each time, the fancied disaster was found to be the forerunner of increased prosperity. There seem to be certain limits beyond which no nation can extend itself without incurring the danger of disunion and decay. We have lost many dependencies, which perhaps, after all, were more expensive than beneficial. But we can never lose the glory of having been the mother country of almost half the civilized globe, and of having conveyed all that is most valuable to human nature into regions which before our coming were the seats either of tyrannical despotism or savage ignorance. Let us only look at the number of mighty nations that were first nursed into civilization under our sway. And then, should anyone ask what country since the world began has done the greatest portion of substantial good, I think we may fearlessly tell them, England.
Yeah, yeah.
You have just heard Phil Proctor, Abby Hopgood, and Nathan Osgood in an abridgment of a dialogue for the year 2130, written in 1829 by T.H. Lister. And now, my dears, we give you Ira Burton, Nathan Osgood, who help author Wayland Young make The Choice.
Help me into the time machine, Carruthers.
Here you go, Williams, old man.
Let's go over the list, shall we?
Camera?
Check.
Tape recorder?
Check.
Notepad?
Check. Well, little boy, I'm off for mankind's first journey into the future.
Good luck.
Yes. Throw the switch like a good chap, will you?
Goodbye. Don't stay too long.
I shan't. I'm back. What time is it?
Only seconds after you left.
I was gone 10 years.
Well, you don't look a day older. You're quite all right.
This is a fiddle. Help me out of this contraption, would you?
Of course. So, how was the future?
The future? Well, the thing is, I can't remember.
Can't remember? Not a thing.
No, not a thing.
But your notes, the camera, the recording machine.
Take a look.
The notebook is empty. There's no film in the camera, no tape in the machine. Good heavens! Why, how did it happen? Can you remember nothing at all?
I can remember only one thing.
What is that?
I was shown everything, and I was given the choice whether I should remember it or not after I got back.
And you chose not to?
Apparently.
But what an extraordinary thing to do.
Isn't it? One can't help wondering why.
While I was walking down the beach one bright and sunny day, I saw a great big wooden box a-floating in the bay. I pulled it in and opened it up, and much to my surprise, ooh, I discovered a... Right before my eyes, ooh, I discovered a... Right before my eyes, I picked it up and ran to town as happy as a king. I took it to a guy I knew who'd buy most anything. But this is what he hollered at me as I walked in his shop. Ooh, get out of here with that. Before I call a cop. Ooh, get out of here with that. Before I call a cop. I turned around and got right out of running for my life. And then I took it home with me to give it to my wife. But this is what she hollered at me as I walked in the door. Oh, get out of here with that. And don't come back no more. Oh, get out of here with that. And don't come back no more. I wandered all around the town until I chanced to meet a hobo who was looking for a hand.
In addition to these NPR broadcasts, 2000X may be downloaded from the internet at www.audible.com, where you will find a library of 22,000 hours of spoken word audio. The 2000X series may be listened to at your PC or on a variety of Audible-ready mobile digital audio players for listening anytime, anywhere. www.audible.com.
The moral of the story is, if you're out on the beach and you should see a great big box and it's within your reach, don't ever stop and open it up. That's my advice to you. 'Cause you'll never get rid of them, no matter what you do. Oh, you'll never get rid of them.